History happened everywhere.
The verdict.
This is our after show podcast where we look back at the most recent episode, number 89, Mind the Gap in Oceania during 1644 to 1912 CE. So if you haven't listened to that, go back and check it out, or else you will encounter spoilers ahead. Is everybody settled?
Yes.
Shall I begin? Listen with Peter.
Oh, God.
Hello, my name is Pete Goddard, and I'm here in the HHE studio with the Tupia to my banks. It's Mr. Ryan Weir.
Oh, I see what you've done there. Can I stay in your bedroom?
You certainly can.
Shove over and give me a pillow.
Well, it's going to be tight because we're also joined, as ever, by the discombobulated dandy of discovery. It's the judge himself, Mr. Paul Dursley.
Kea ora ana.
Ah, very good. That's hello, isn't it, in Maori or something?
Yes.
Have you been preparing by doing a haka? Ready for war. Pre-podcast haka.
Now, Ryan, I have, for the last week, been exploring the uncharted territory around my house, and I have discovered a land I have named South Croydon. But in all the excitement, I've also forgotten all about the episode. So can you remind me of what we talked about?
I can do that, Peter, but when would you like me to do it?
I'd like you to do it now.
Well, in this week's journey through time and tide, we dove into the vast expanse of Oceania, deep into the London Underground and through a gap in time between 1644 to 1912. Amid the inhabitants of hundreds of islands from atolls to Australia, we met Tupia, a Polynesian navigator whose expertise helped Captain Cook bridge the vast cultural gaps between Europe and the Pacific Islands. And we ventured to Heavitree Gap, a sacred site in the Australian outback where local indigenous folk manned a crucial pass of spiritual significance through the McDonnell Mountain Range, or at least they did until the meddlesome arrival of some meddling Europeans. It was Mind the Gap, it was Oceania, it was 1644 to 1912.
Last week's episode done, summarised nicely, nice one son. Now we're over to a young Dursley, who's gonna tell you what he thought of thee. He'll take you apart without any care, he's the lovely Paul Dursley, the lovely Paul Dursley.
Ah, yes, I remember now. What an episode. Cleverly done. Brought in the topic. But before we start, we're here for the opinion of one man, Mr. Paul Dursley. So, Paul, what were your first impressions of the episode?
What's the past participle of dive?
Divide, died, divided, dived, did it.
Dived, not dove.
Starting strong.
Well, yeah, given that you keep on giving the name of the thing wrong, it's Oceania.
Right.
Well.
Well, I looked it up and it seems like there are many different ways of saying it. Oceania, Oceania, Oceania. Oceania. So I think depending on where you come from in the world, you can pronounce it however you like.
But Paul, other than pronunciation debates, did you enjoy the episode overall?
I think it was, let's say, a satisfactory episode.
I'll take that.
Ooh, well, is this because you learnt so many new things?
Well, not really.
Right.
But new details. Well, I learned a load of new things. I wasn't aware of Tupia. I had heard of Captain Cook, but Tupia was absolutely news to me. But I remember, Ryan, you said that Cook had to unseal his orders, and I was quite curious as to why he received sealed orders. And it's pretty much what you would think in the first instance, that obviously they weren't telephoning each other in those days, so you'd have to send your package of orders. And if you didn't want anyone on the way to read it and you wanted only the captain to read it, it would arrive sealed. But the question we were talking about was, when did he open his packet?
Yeah, my suspicion was that he steamed it open on the way, because that's a year of sitting there looking at a sealed envelope. I suspect you would be too curious just to leave it.
Exactly. And so in the book Blue Latitudes, Boldly Going Where Captain Cook Has Gone Before, a guy called Tony Horwitz writes, Cook left no record of when he opened the sealed packet of secret orders he'd been given by the Admiralty. So I'm saying he got about 100 yards off the coast of Plymouth and he had that thing open immediately.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I would have thought it was later than that, because you wouldn't opened it until you're definitely underway, and also where there was no chance of the French coming up and stealing them. Because that was basically the reason for it.
That makes a lot of sense.
So it would probably be, you know, a month or so out, because as the captain of the ship, he's effectively God. He could do what he likes. He can have men executed if he wishes.
And I can only imagine he had limited reading material, so at some point that sealed packet was the only thing left to read on the ship.
Yes, and so it's not as if, even if there was a spy on board, they couldn't really tell the French, could they?
True, but I did also look a bit more at the document itself. So the wording of the orders say, amongst other things, you're to observe the nature of the soil and the products thereof. You're likewise to observe the genius, temper, disposition and number of the natives, if there be any, and endeavour by all proper means to cultivate a friendship and alliance with them, making them presents of such trifles as they may value, inviting them to traffic and showing them every kind of civility and regard.
That's unexpected, really, isn't it?
I thought it was going to say, and trample all over them and take everything you can find. There are some details, though. They say, taking care, however, not to suffer yourself to be surprised by them, but be always upon your guard against any accident. But overall, they seem to be saying, come on, just make friends with these guys rather than necessarily stomp on their lives. But then, down to business, it says, you're also, with the consent of the natives, to take possession of any convenient situations in the country in the name of the King of Great Britain. Or, if you find the country uninhabited, take possession for His Majesty by setting up proper marks and inscriptions as first discoverers and possessors.
Oh, I want to know what the first inscriptions are and markers.
Just Cook was here, scratched on a wall. That'll do you.
So did they, get all the captains together and give them, a presentation on what to do if you find an uninhabited island? And
possibly. There may have been. There was a lot of it happening then.
That's kind of fascinating, isn't it? Imagine just all these captains getting together and all the stories they had to share. Amazing. You said you know quite a bit about James Cook.
Yes, and I do take quite offence at your portrayal of him, because for the time, he was very enlightened.
So I was going to point that out, actually. I was going to say, the story that we told was obviously framed around Tupaia and pointing out the fact that his story had not been told for almost 200 years and that Cook took a lot of the credit for the work that Tupaia did. That being said, though, as I did point out at the end, there are a lot of people that say that he does deserve a lot of credit for the work that he did. So presumably you fall on that side of the fence.
Yes, I do. As of the nature of the time, he occasionally had to flog members of the crew, but not as often as compared to lots of other captains of the time. And actually, he wasn't a captain.
Oh.
Well, that's news.
Did he know that?
This just in.
What was he then?
I think he was a lieutenant.
Huh.
But he was a post-captain.
Wait, is that why he had a sealed envelope?
I.e. he was the sort of the most senior officer on the ship. So he was the captain of the ship, but he did not hold the rank of captain.
Couldn't they have just made him a captain? He's obviously the captain of the ship. We call him, for example, Captain Cook.
Yes, but it's like the term skipper, isn't it? That's informally used in English-speaking navies, which is sort of the most important person on a ship. But only big ships have captains. Most of the ships sort of have lieutenants or whatever the next one up is.
Right tenants.
No. The smaller ships are sort of run by commanders or lieutenant commanders.
Oh.
That would have been better, wouldn't it? Lieutenant Commander Cook.
Yeah, because I'm not very good at military titles. I don't really know which ones are higher than which ones, outside of admiral being pretty good and general being top. Mm. So if you're a commander or a lieutenant, it's basically all the same to me. I don't know who to obey. I'll just look at how much gold braid you've got and go in that direction.
You just saluted people.
Basically, I'll salute anything. Any passerby will get a salute from me.
And also, Joseph Banks was one of the richest men in the country.
He was a rich man, you're right. That's why
he paid for his passage and put up sureties and things.
Which makes you wonder, if he was so wealthy, why he deemed sharing his cabin was so necessary.
Well, I think it was a lack of another cabin to put him in. It's not like there's a big Airbnb market on the boat.
I think it was a lack of cabin, although your stories were quite amusing. he did, as did most of the people on that voyage, have two wives.
Tupaia?
No, Joseph Banks.
Two wives?
Yes, he had a wife at home and a wife in Tahiti.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, the sexual mores of the Tahitians were totally different to the Westerners. And there was no consideration of sort of ownership in terms of marriage. So it's, oh, here's my wife. Would you like to take her?
Right.
That said, if you are going to hide something, one wife in the UK and one in Tahiti at a time with no phone or satellite contact is a reasonably secure way to go about it, isn't it?
Yes, but wasn't there a rule in the Royal Navy in the 18th century that after 90 days away, buggery was no longer a capital offence?
Oh, is that right? Okay. Just waiting for... How long left, Captain?
Making a dash for the international dateline.
I don't know whether... I haven't checked, so I don't know whether that's apocryphal or not.
Unfortunately, the idea that homosexual acts were allowed or overlooked by the Royal Navy after a certain period at sea is a myth rather than an actual rule. In fact, under naval law, buggery was considered to be a serious offence in the 18th century, punishable by death. The enforcement of this was always at the captain's discretion, though, and very few instances of capital punishment are recorded. Thank you.
So, to go back to the sealed orders, you can, in fact, or in 2020, you could have a look at them. The instructions themselves are on display at the Australian National Maritime Museum. They're currently held by the National Library of Australia. I've got a picture of them that we can put on our social media.
Great.
But the thing that tickled me most is these sealed orders that we've been talking about
were filled with glitter.
No, they just look like a letter, as you might know. But in the top left-hand corner, in the same handwriting, it just says, "Secret."
Oh, right.
I don't know what I was expecting, but I didn't feel like a hugely significant way to say, look, no one must see this. Just a secret in the top corner in handwriting.
Oh, it was important in those days, right? Nowadays, we see it in movies and TV shows all the time. It's lost its power. But then something with "secret" written on it, I'm sure that sent a shiver through your backbone.
Yeah, the French spies would see that and go, well, I better not read that. It's
a
secret.
That's it. Well, look, just on that, I do have more information about Tupaia and his journey with Cook.
Tell us more.
Well, I can't. It's in a sealed envelope. And so I will unseal it after this. All right, gentlemen, I have the sealed envelope here. Let's open it up. So we spoke about Tupaia and his voyage with Captain Cook on the HMS Endeavour, but the Endeavour was not the first European ship that Tupaia had encountered. 2 years earlier, June 1767, another British ship arrived in Tahiti, the HMS Dolphin, and Captain Samuel Wallace was in charge, and he was in a bit of a desperate situation. He'd arrived there in the Pacific Ocean around about the 11th of April, and the crew got scurvy, which, as we know, can only be cured by eating fresh vegetables and fruit. So when they sighted Tahiti and they saw all the lush plantation fruit and veg hanging everywhere, they were delighted. So they started trading with the locals, exchanging nails and spikes from the ship in exchange for pigs and poultry and fruit. But when Wallace then learned that the locals were starting to steal from the crew, conflict broke out between the two groups. And that all culminated in this one big full-blooded attack on the ship by a fleet of Tahitian canoes that Wallace then decided he would defend the ship with by countering by a broadside of cannon shot.
Canoes against cannons, that's not a greatly fair fight, is it?
No, it really wasn't a great fight. But at that point, steps in our man Tupaia. He saw a political advantage in building an alliance. And so when he approached the ship, Wallace actually welcomed him on board. Wallace himself was actually looking for somebody that he could try and influence to give him Tahiti, basically to sort of hand it over. But as they were discussing this, negotiations were sort of ongoing, but it never actually happened because his crew were so intersex with the local women that they had wrenched out enough nails and spikes from the ship to trade for sex that the ship itself started to fall apart and it was in danger of being unseaworthy. And so Wallace pulls anchor and leaves.
This creaky vessel.
And this is a few months before the HMS Endeavour is due to set sail. Now, he tells the Admiralty all about Tahiti. He says how amazing it is.
Take nails.
Take lots of nails, he says. And Cook's orders get amended. They hand them over to him and he's told to travel there as basically the stopping point. Now, a number of Wallace's crew were so desperate to return to Tahiti, they signed up and were members of the HMS Endeavour underneath Cook. The Admiralty, though, were annoyed by Wallace's lethal use of cannon and muskets against the Tahitians. That was the reason why he got those instructions to be more friendly. The president of the Royal Society confronted Cook and went further. He said, "Restrain from the wanton use of firearms, and to remember that the shedding of native blood was a crime of the highest nature."
Nice. Oh, that's good. So we do make fun of our exploring forebears, but it wasn't all go get them and smash them up, was it?
Well, it was for a reason they were told not to do that. Let's not forget the broadside of cannon shot on canoes. But yeah, so that's why when Cook arrived, he was doing principally scientific-y stuff, and why Banks then made friends with Tupaia. But the one thing I didn't mention during the episode was that Tupaia wasn't the only Tahitian on board the Endeavour. On the 18th of April, 1769, Cook's records show that Tupaia, native of Polynesia, was joined by Taria, Nunaho, Tupuruura Tamita, and Taheto. And Taheto was a 12-year-old boy, which Cook just assumed was Tupaia's servant or assistant. And all of these islanders got on board the boat and they all helped Cook for the first 3 months or so as they were navigating through the islands around Tahiti. But over those 3 months, Tupaia stood out as being especially knowledgeable of them and skilled. He even learned a bit of English during those 3 months. Banks wrote in his journal, "I do not know why I may not keep him as a curiosity, as well as some of my neighbours do lions and tigers." So just wanting to keep him as a curiosity. And by the way, this is after Tupaia had saved Banks's life. They stopped on an island and there was like a house of God. And Banks went inside this house of God and just started like rooting around, touching idols. And he touched like,
what does this one do?
This big godlike creature. And so Tupaia stood in and sort of quick talked him out of trouble.
He's not a trespasser, he's just a fool.
Yeah. So anyway, Tupaia and Taiata, they both stayed on board the boat. And they both died together. When I mentioned that Tupaia died when they reached Australia, the little boy announced, "My friends, I am dying." And he did. And 3 days later, in total grief, Tupaia gave up himself to grief. And Tupaia's only memorial is an entry in Cook's journal. "He was a shrewd, sensible, ingenious man, but proud and obstinate, which often made his situation on board both disagreeable to himself and those about him."
Oh, dude, just be nice for once. Oh, dear.
That's the final word on Tupaia.
Harsh, Cook. Harsh. No wonder he never made captain.
This is a little aside, but did you know that they had fresh milk on those voyages around the world?
I did not know that. Was that from goats or rats or what?
Yes, it was from goat's milk.
Okay.
And the same goat went on all three of Cook's journeys. So this goat went around the world 3 times on his expeditions. Of course, he was killed on the third expedition, but the goat came back and I think it lived in Shoreditch when it came back and it died a natural death. So I think there's a statue to it somewhere.
Are you sure you've read this right and it wasn't his nanny that he took with him or his kid?
No, it was his goat.
So do you think to this day it's the most travelled goat?
That's probably still the most travelled goat, the goat of goat travellers.
Guinness World Records, get on it.
Nice. Now, Ryan.
Peter.
You earlier said that Cook had gone to do his scientific-y things, didn't you?
I did indeed, yeah.
So you told me that he was there to measure the transit of Venus, and you didn't know what that was.
I think I said, whatever that is.
Exactly so. Now, I have looked it up so I can explain what it is for you. And okay. It's quite an interesting story, actually, because it's kind of a very early example of what you might call big science. It was actually part of a global venture to answer a key question about the universe.
Wow.
So, first of all, what is it? What is the transit of Venus? I'm sure Paul will be able to tell us.
Mm-hmm.
And then you tell us.
a transit of any planet is the movement of the planet across the star. So, in fact, last week there was a transit of the moon, also known as a solar eclipse. So it is when a body occults, i.e. goes in front of a star.
Exactly. So he said that far better than I could have done. So what they were doing was measuring the time it took for Venus to cross in front of the sun. So why were they doing that is the next question. Well, if you can measure that with the addition of some maths and a few different people in different places around the world also looking at that, and use that in order to calculate the distance between the sun and the earth. This is a measurement known as one astronomical unit, or AU, and that helps us understand the size of the universe. So they were looking at some pretty big questions there.
Wow, okay, that's amazing. How did they look at the sun in those days? Surely they would have blinded themselves.
Well, it's even more interesting than that, so we'll come to that. But the actual question is, why was it such a big deal at the time? Why would you want to travel halfway around the world? Well, viewable transits of Venus are not very common at all. They do happen in pairs. For example, the most recent transit of Venus was in 2012. So I don't know if you caught that one, Ryan.
No, I wasn't in Tahiti then.
Okay, well, don't have to be in Tahiti. But if you missed that, don't worry, you can get the next one, which is in 105 years time, 2117.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'll see that one either.
Right, so when Cook was sailing in 1769, this was basically a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make this measurement that would enable them to make these calculations to discover this thing about the size of the universe. So it's not exactly once-in-a-lifetime, it's kind of the second of a twice-in-a-lifetime opportunity, because I said that these transits tend to happen in pairs, or do happen in pairs. The first one happened in 1761. So at that time, scientists again were sent all over the world to observe the phenomenon and measure the thing across. But what they discovered wasn't, unfortunately, the timing of the transit, it was a thing called the black drop effect.
Oh yes, that was the thing where you get the effect of almost like a teardrop because of the diffraction.
Exactly. So instead of seeing what you want to see, which is a sort of perfect circle of the planet coming across the sun, the borders kind of merge, and as Paul says, you get this kind of teardrop effect, hence the black drop effect. And because they needed a precise timing, this blurring droppy effect meant they couldn't get it. So at the end of it, they just didn't have very accurate measurements at all. But I guess they had discovered the black drop effect at least, so it wasn't a total dead loss.
Does it need to be entirely accurate, or can you just, like, I mean, guesstimate, surely?
It has to be pretty accurate. The drop effect is believed to be partly related to the viewing tools. So they're using telescopes, and I assume they're not just looking through with their eyes, but
the sun.
Well, they're using a sextant.
And how are they using that, Paul?
Well, it uses mirrors and smoked glass in the path of the ray, so you can actually look at the sun. Because what you have to do is you have to get the sun exactly on the horizon, or exactly at noon.
There you go. So basically, all this adds up to the fact that Cook's voyage was actually a part of a global second attempt to measure the transit of Venus to develop this calculation for the astronomical unit. And so it wasn't just Cook. There was observations all around the world, in North Cape in Norway, Hudson Bay in Canada. And the second time around, they nailed it, basically. Their calculations came to within 4% of what we now believe that number to be, which I'm sure you're dying to know. It's about 150 million kilometres.
Wow.
So what you dismissed, Ryan, as whatever that is, turns out to be quite an important little bit of science going on.
I didn't dismiss nothing. I said he was doing important scientific stuff. So
that's true.
Points to me.
Now you know what it is.
All right, so there was one other story that I wanted to include in the main episode, but didn't really fit in the time period. And that is around the Olafka Coconut Man.
Oh, everyone knows the Olafka Coconut Man.
Right, exactly. So this is located in Samoa, and Samoa is home to two main islands, the largest and more sort of untouched island being Savahai. Essentially, it's a huge volcano with multiple peaks that has lush rainforests all the way around it and rivers that flow from the mountains to the coast. There is several quaint little villages that are nestled around the place, sheltered coves in the south, beautiful coral sands. It's a kind of a paradise on Earth.
Well, I've been there.
Oh. Have you really? Yes. Okay.
Yes, I was ill, though, when I was there. By the time I got there, I was wanting to get off because I was so ill. So I didn't really know much about it. I could just remember that I couldn't shave because my skin was so raw.
Oh, poor Judge Dursley.
It's a long way to go to be ill.
Yeah. Well, yes, it is because I just wanted to get home, but you just couldn't. There are only 2 flights a week. So if you just missed one, you had 3 or 4 days to wait to the next one.
Okay, well, maybe you know the Coconut Man.
No, I've never heard of the Coconut Man.
So, on this beautiful island, a number of small little quaint villages, one of which is in the southwest of the island. It's a village named Taga. And in this village is a guy called Tofua. And he's affectionately known to tourists as the Alofaga Coconut Man. Now, Tofua has carved out a bit of a niche for himself in his village because he sells coconuts to tourists. However, the real attraction begins when Tofua showcases the natural spectacle of Alofaga's blowholes. Now, these blowholes are formed by ancient lava tubes. This is where the lava flowed and created essentially like a big straw all the way down from the cliff top down to the ocean below. And as waves crash against the cliffs, it pushes water into these tubes. They force water at high pressure through the tube up into the air from the top of the cliff top up to 60 meters high. It's an incredible series of fountains that go off every time a wave hits. Now, Tofua's role extends beyond just selling coconuts to tourists. He then entertains the tourists by placing the empty coconut shells into the mouths of the blowhole just before it erupts, which sends the coconuts soaring into the air, preceded by a round of applause by happy tourists. It is a unique show. Coconut cannons that go off every couple of seconds.
On. You can see that anywhere you get volcanic tubes and a weirdo with a bunch of coconuts at the top.
But it's a job that he says he takes very seriously because while he loves entertaining people, he also takes responsibility for minding these gaps in the thing.
Oh, you made it.
The area is unfenced, and so he worries that a tourist might slip off the cliff into the ocean. Obviously, there's lots of water about, or indeed fall into one of these holes, which sounds a bit of a disaster because then you'd be
flying
shot
out
60 meters into the air.
That's one hell of an anal douche.
Yes, it would give you quite the cleansing, wouldn't it? So there you go. That is a man who minds the gaps.
Oh, my Lord. Well, this is it. The time has come. We've come to the end of the line and it's time for Ryan to step into the dock and prepare to face the people's judge.
Can I bring a Tapia with me to face the judge and negotiate on my behalf?
No, sir. You are on your own. Judge Dursley, are you ready to give your verdict?
Yes, I am.
Then will the defendant please rise?
I have risen.
Your Honour, as usual, can we start proceedings by first asking for your verdict on factual content?
Well, factual content was somewhat lacking, I feel, in places in this episode, as I knew a little bit about the subject. And I actually knew about the mind, the gap voice as well. I knew that story as well.
So factual content, your grade please, Paul.
Okay, I'll have to dock you a mark or two for the Oceania debacle. So,
damn it,
I shall give you C+.
Hey, I'm happy with a C+, Pete.
Okay, well, you take that and we'll move on to the next section, which is, of course, entertainment value. Did you enjoy yourself, Paul?
Well, I thought for once you had a couple of hits in the sketches.
Woohoo! I wrote those. They were mine.
So I enjoyed that. It did tickle my fancy, and it's a part of the world I have been to, and it's a part of the world I'm fascinated by. But also the Mind the Gap and the London Underground stories. It's another of my incredibly tedious but enjoyable interests. So I will give you, for entertainment factor, I will give you A minus.
What the heck?
Good gosh and crikey, I can't believe it.
What?
That's an excellent score.
What?
I can't believe it. The crowd's gone wild. And of course, we come to the unknowable, the mysterious, the ineffable Dursley factor. What is your grade, Paul?
Well, first of all, I cannot accept that the transit of Venus is a, what did you say, a whatever that is.
I did. That is literally what I said. I said it under my breath, though. So, does that count?
That's an important part of the thing. So, I'm afraid for that, this anti-scientific sentiment, I'm going to have to be a bit harsh on this one.
Ah.
And I'll give you C.
That's a diverse range of grades.
So it was quite interesting, but just because it was funny, it doesn't necessarily mean it's right.
Well, this brings us to the final verdict. But before the judge passes his ruling, Ryan, this is your opportunity to enter a plea. If you choose to do so, please plea now.
Yeah, I do, actually. Yeah. So my plea is this. You criticised my saying of Oceana.
You are on very, very shaky ground.
However,
that tsunami is rushing up behind you.
However, I would like to point out, Your Honour, that I also got a lot of other pronunciations wrong. A lot of names, Tapaya, I probably got that wrong. A lot of the indigenous names I got wrong. So I would just like to say that it falls within the broader bracket of me not being able to verbalise the names of places. So,
oh my goodness.
Do your worst.
Well, yeah. So thank you very much for pointing out all of the things that you got wrong.
So, Your Honour, Ryan has spoken. The defendant now stands before you. Have you reached your final verdict?
Well, I'm surprised that Ryan hasn't learned, because he has told me all of the things he got wrong about that episode. So I'm afraid there is a last minute amendment to this score.
Oh, well, I must ask then, most respectfully, Judge, for your final ruling.
I'm afraid, Ryan, I should give you D plus.
Ah, come on, you could have at least done a B minus.
Self-inflicted D.
But I was just sitting there and my mouth was opening wider and wider and wider for all of these things.
D plus? Come on.
So that is it. That is our show for this week. If you would like to get in touch about any of the things we've talked about on the show, or you just want to say hello, you can reach us on social media through our website at hhepodcast.com, or you can email Pete and Ryan at hhepodcast.com.
Yeah, that's right. We love hearing from you. And you never know, you might end up featured on a future show.
And one way to definitely do that is to rate and review the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And your recommendations there really help bring the show to new listeners.
That's right. And if you're Keb and you keep giving us 5-star reviews on Good Pods, then keep doing that.
Yes, please keep doing that. Be like Keb.
So what reviews does he give on Bad Pods?
Hey!
We haven't checked out Bad Pods. Now, if you are on Mastodon, Facebook, Instagram, or X, you can find us at HHE Podcast. And if you subscribe to those, you're going to get an alert every time we post any trivia tidbits, news, and photos.
Yeah, we'll put a little picture of the captain's sealed orders up as well.
Sounds good.
And of course, we'll be back again soon with our next episode, episode 90, Peace in Africa During the Jurassic.
That's actually going to be very difficult, given that Africa didn't exist then.
Totally defeated by a technicality. But in the meantime, a huge thank you to the judge himself. Thank you, Paul.
My pleasure, as ever.
And that's it. I guess all that's left to say is...
you've been listening to...
Westminster. This is a Circle Line train via Embankment and Tower Hill.
I don't know whether you want to use this. Yeah, it's a part of the world that I like and have been to a couple of times, actually. And I went, the first time I went to the Cook Islands, which are lovely, lovely, lovely islands. And the international airport, they have like a Hawaiian guitar, which is actually Polynesian, chap doing the singing with all of the flower leis around. And so he does the song, and then he'll stop the song and sing the next departure and go back to the song. I thought that was rather good.